Joining us in a studio, Ian Bessarabi, the future of work. And today I want to, I said to Ian yesterday on the passing of Jack Walsh, I wondered how will he be remembered? Ian, a very, very good morning. How are you?
I'm very well, thanks. And you, Howard?
Yes, excellent, thank you. First of all, you had some experience, before we actually talk about that topic, you had some experience at one of the private hospitals yesterday, and you found it quite interesting in terms of how we're starting to change our behavior around potential coronavirus activity here in South Africa.
Absolutely, Howard, and thank you for giving me the opportunity to chat about this. So I have to kind of maybe kind of go against your feelings that we're all going to die.
Oh.
Yeah, because we're not all going to die, Howard. Well, look, let me contextualize that. If we're going to a private hospital, I can't talk for the public hospitals, but if we're going to a private hospital, I feel we're going to be in good hands, and let me give you some context to it. So, yes, you correctly mentioned we went into one of the well-known private hospitals yesterday, and I was firstly very impressed as we walked in the door. There's a gentleman standing there, and he insists, well, he actually, like, he won't let you pass him unless you've sprayed your hands.
Absolutely brilliant. So that's, well, especially in a hospital. People are vulnerable in a hospital.
Absolutely.
So you want to bring something in to that hospital. Yeah. You're actually putting other people at risk.
Absolutely. And then as you walk through the hospital, through the passages, they've got these big blue posters, and they're big posters. It's not like a little pamphlet sitting on a table in the corner. It's a big blue poster that has guidelines, and it's actually put out by the World Health Organization. So this looks like it's something that's been globally pushed out, and then it's kind of
and what does it have on it?
So on there it actually has some guidance in terms of reduce your risk of coronavirus infection, and they say here, clean hands. Mm-hmm. Clean hands with soap and water or alcohol-based hand rub. I actually asked if I could use whiskey, and the lady didn't think it was too funny. But anyway, well, they don't have a sense of humor. But it's good because they're taking it serious. Mm-hmm. The other thing is cover nose and mouth when coughing and sneezing with tissue or flexed elbow. Never tried the flexed elbow approach.
That's this.
Oh, yes. Okay.
Into your...
Yeah. Avoid close contact with anyone with cold or flu-like symptoms.
Right.
Thoroughly cook meat and eggs. I found that one quite interesting.
Yeah, that is interesting. I didn't know that was a thing.
Absolutely. Right. And then the last one was avoid unprotected contact with live, wild, or farm animals.
Oh, gosh. I thought you said avoid unprotected sex with
wild. No.
Wild.
Yeah. I saw something that you were like,
What? You mean it? What? Okay, well, just say that again.
Okay,
while
so
I explain my breath.
Absolutely.
So it's not to avoid unprotected sex with wild animals.
No, certainly not, Howard. Please don't start it.
Because we've seen some posters with that line.
Yes.
Okay, so this is avoid unprotected contact with live, wild, or farm animals. Well, you can read that as you want.
Yes.
But that was like their kind of tips in that. But then as you go through the whole hospital admission process, they've actually added, you know, for those of you that have been admitted to hospital, they have this whole procedure where they ask you a bunch of questions. And the interesting thing I found was that we are well prepared for this. And I tell you why we're well prepared for this is because we've been doing it for a long time with the Ebola virus. As you know, a lot of patients come in from our neighboring countries and other countries in Africa. They come to South Africa for the healthcare and the treatment. So a stock standard procedure has been the Ebola questions that they typically ask, and they still ask them. So this has now just become, I hate to call it an addendum, but it's become like an added page or questionnaire that is added to a patient's file, and they go through every
And it's interesting
list.
That you say that, because I'm sure that South African hospitals are well, much better geared because of the amount of people coming here from other parts of Africa with certain tropical diseases, with things that we don't really, we're not used to encountering here in South Africa. So maybe we are better prepared. Interesting that Gimple says, so only the privileged won't die. Actually, so let me just tell you a little bit about this as well. Where this is important, Ian, and as far as I understand from my conversations with a lot of people who are very, very involved in this, from what I understand is, number one, I agree with you, is that we are very, very well prepared. The private hospitals certainly are training staff, but what they're actually trying to do, to my knowledge, is to stop people with potential coronavirus from actually even coming into the hospitals. There are going to be certain designated hospitals where people with coronavirus will be treated. So what they're trying to do is stop the spread within certain areas. Obviously, if somebody's already in hospital and they contract and they prove positive for coronavirus, that's a different story. But there are very, very good protocols in place in South Africa, and I do think that we are well geared. My concern, actually, first of all, a lot of my stuff, of course, is flippant. I don't think we're all going to die. I mean, I think a fair amount of us, but not every single one of us. That would be complete exaggeration. But Ansan says we should put that hospital in Prakpan. Wow.
Ooh.
And I thought I was bad.
Wow.
And I thought I was bad. I do believe my concern is what happens if we become overwhelmed.
Yeah.
And that is my issue. And as I said yesterday, my concern is around, areas where in South Africa, unfortunately, many South Africans don't have access to running water, which is absolutely required for hygiene, for keeping, where people are living more people than should be to very small, in very small spaces. That's my worry. Because if it goes through areas like that, I don't know how we'll be able to control it. Now, you add to that the fact that often the poor in our community are at risk because they haven't had access to good medical. They haven't got access to a good balanced diet. So they actually are going to be the most at risk in our whole community. So unfortunately, what Gimpel is saying to some extent is true, that the vulnerable in our community are people who are living in poverty-like conditions.
Yeah.
And that is a huge, huge worry for me. I do think that once you remove that aspect from it, I think that healthcare will be provided for everybody. And I do think that the system that has been set up is a very, very good, strong, stringent one. And I think we are very, very privileged to have the kind of medical systems here that we do. The department, the various departments are doing a very, very good job, I think, of preparing for it.
So Howard, if I could just add one thing, and the thing that was very comforting for me yesterday, and this is something to Gimpel's point, which I think he's 100% correct, but I certainly think we can take a lesson out of what I've shared from yesterday, is that when we arrived at the hospital, there was no panic. There was no like tent erected outside on the street and people walking around with like hazmat outfits and all of this. And when you walked in, there wasn't paranoia where everybody was handing out a mask. So for me, the lesson we can learn from there is effective communication and making sure that people are managing the situation calmly, but effectively. And to your point is that we need to start communicating with people, and the second thing is we need to be gathering data.
But not
data.
Through hugging and kissing and shaking hands.
No contact,
hands.
No contact.
Just
no, we just to be out there. But Howard, if we can communicate more to the communities, and it doesn't have to be long. People don't read, so if you have one poster with five top things not to do, and they've got to be practical and they've got to be realistic. If we don't, for want of a better word, if we don't panic and get hysterical about it. I also think that there are ways and means of ensuring that we keep tabs on this. That doesn't mean that we won't have a pandemic. We won't have, but I think we'll be better equipped, like you say, to manage it if we communicate effectively and if we gather that data and share that data in a constructive way.
All right. And Jonathan, thank you for sending me this earlier. Very, very interesting indeed. The Yeshiva World News reporting that following the Motzei Shabbat report about members of a group of South Korean tourists who were diagnosed with coronavirus on their return home from a tour of Israel, and hundreds of Israelis who were instructed to self-quarantine, Kikar HaShabbat asked the chief rabbi of Israel, so the chief rabbi was asked about the halachic, in other words, the religious aspect of self-quarantine. And this is what he responded. Rav Lau responded that anyone who is required to remain in isolation is forbidden from praying at a synagogue with a community. So that's very, very, very strong and important words from the chief rabbi of Israel. Anyone who is required to remain in isolation is forbidden from prayer with a community. It is forbidden. That applies to anyone at risk of harming another person, even if the chances are very slight. Likewise, it is forbidden to enter a place of danger, and therefore one should refrain from visiting places where there is a risk of contracting the virus. So very, very, very interesting. And he says, matters of health are granted to a man, and a person should utilize whatever knowledge he has to protect himself from an illness and infections and distance himself from them. This is a Torah commandment. Very, very strong words from the chief rabbi of Israel, and I believe very important words as well. All right, Ian, we've been sitting here for 33 minutes and we haven't said a word about the guy that passed away yesterday, not from coronavirus. Who was Jack Walsh?
Okay, so Howard, when you sent me the message yesterday, it was quite interesting. I was reading the same article. Jack Walsh he's best known, as General Electric's leader, and he's like put in that category like Thomas Edison, you know, that's the kind of esteem that Jack Walsh has got. But the interesting thing, so yes, you're correct. He didn't die of coronavirus. He died of renal failure, at the age of, if I'm not mistaken, it was 84. Yes. So he passed away on Sunday at the age of 84. But what is interesting is having done some research on Jack Walsh, he's got a very interesting, past, but, he's also got, there's this very diverse views about him. So Jack Walsh was known as his famous tagline was fix it, close it or sell it. And that fix it, close it or sell it, was really about like really looking harshly at General Electric in the early 80s and saying this company is not sustainable. So we have to make tough decisions. And he was lauded for the decisions that he made with regards to breaking down bureaucracy and uplifting management and really weeding out, so as to speak, the non-performers in companies. And there's a lot of positives that come out of that. And, at the same time, we've got on the other side is we've got a lot of people that, did not enjoy, his leadership style. And I think that's what makes him such an interesting person to dissect. So on the one hand, you've got people that will look at him and say, wow, this guy took a company from $12 billion to $410 billion during his tenure. Mm. So on paper, he was fantastic. Mm. But if you looked at how many people's jobs were kind of lost, how many people, and that's why he's got the controversial name. They either say, will Jack Walsh be remembered as manager of the century?
What's so interesting to me is that he already isn't. So at the time, I know that when he was writing his books about management, they were all a rage. I didn't like them.
Yeah.
I didn't like his approach, and I didn't like him, and I didn't like his style. He's not somebody that resonated for me at all. He, to me, was the quintessential sort of tough American CEO that said it's all about business and it doesn't matter about people within that. I mean, I don't know if that was right or wrong. That was my perception of him, and therefore I kind of resisted his style completely.
Absolutely.
But what I have noticed is that it's not a name that people are still referring to some years later around management style, and I wonder why.
It's very interesting, Howard, and as you say, it's not surprising that that one of the first people to come out and talk about Jack Walsh after his passing was Donald Trump.
Right. So I would imagine they're similar.
Absolutely,
similar style of leadership.
Yeah, and they very much. They must have been very good business friends as well in that approach. And the other thing we have to look at is that there were certain things that were good qualities, as you say, but there are certain things that were very much related to stuff, if you can say that, outside of his control. Now talk about luck. So he he even admitted that nothing is permanent. And he even said at the time that he wouldn't, his style wouldn't last, wouldn't.
Oh, did he say that?
Sustainable. He actually said, he said that, and sometimes it's almost like hard to push a person to admit that you have to fall on your sword. Mm. But if you look at GE and you look at their competitors at the time, GE is the only one that remains in a much different form than the others. And the point I wanted to make about this is the lesson we can learn about Jack Welch's story is he made tough decisions. He made very unpopular decisions at the time.
Mm-hmm.
But if I look at where we are in South Africa at this juncture, if I look at our state-owned entities, if I look at the backlash that Tito's getting with his budget, etc., this is a reality.
Do we need Jack Welch leadership?
Well, we do. And when I say we do, in certain aspects we do. The difference is there a way we can find a balance? And Jack Welch's approach was, like I said at the outset, it was like, fix it, get rid of it, sell it, or whatever the other point was. But the point is that we shouldn't have to get to that point. And the point is we should look and say, well, what can we do to avoid laying off thousands or hundreds of thousands of people from
very,
a company?
Very, very interesting indeed. I'd love your thoughts. Ian Basarabi joining us in studio. Jack Welch passed away over the weekend, and we wanted to get a sense of who he was and what kind of and what he will be remembered for. Ian, you were saying during the song that there are a couple of things that were incredibly – he did incredibly well.
Absolutely, Howard, and I think that's where we should be focusing what we can take from him and then add our own bits of leadership style to it. So the one thing that Jack was good at, he was teaching each and everyone to pause and reflect and ask, what are we doing with every day of our lives? That was something that came out very, very, very strongly in everything he said. And he kind of asked, are we merely existing because that's just how it has been done? And we're caught riding the wave, but it's not the wave that we want to be on. And I love that. You know, like we stand on this wave every day and we look at the other waves and why aren't we just switching waves? And that was his courageous and his decisive way of doing it. It might not have been popular as we discussed earlier, but he questioned. And for me, that is one of the most important things. We should constantly be questioning ourselves, but we should also be questioning everything around us and asking, why are we doing this? Because if we can't give ourselves a good answer or an answer that satisfies us, then perhaps we're not doing the right thing. So questioning was so important. The other thing is he did inspire. Whether you like him or not, he was an inspirer. And he was obsessive with transparency and honesty. And some would say that he overdid it, that he was brutal about it. And that's sometimes where it comes out and you feel the person's overcritical or they say too much. But at the same time, he was just as obsessive about pumping up people and instilling confidence in them that he once said, and I love this quote, one of the jobs you have as a manager is to pump every day self-confidence into your team to make them feel great. To make people like me feel like I've got a full head of hair and I'm 6'10". Welch was 5'7" and bald. And I love that because that shows that every person has to be rowing in the same direction or pulling in the same direction. So,
and it's actually interesting because an article I'm actually busy writing is the heading is Positivity is a Strategy.
Yeah.
And I really believe that positivity is a strategy.
Absolutely.
It isn't just something that's nice to have. It is a strategy and it is absolutely worth following.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what he was saying is because, people need to feel good. People, once they feel good, I'm not sure I'm a believer in making somebody feel that they're 6 foot if they're 4'3".
Yeah.
But it doesn't mean that they can't celebrate other things. And I get what he's saying.
Yeah.
Is it's about inspiring.
It is about inspiring, and one thing that we forget about with leaders is that we look at their capabilities, their business capabilities, and I use that word business very specifically because that is very much linked to IQ. we link people to their ability to lead in the context of running the business, of actually managing that business, whereas we forget about the softer side. And, you know, I would never think of Jack Walsh as a cheerleader. Like, and
no,
it's hard to picture
either.
Him
it's
in that
interesting
role.
Interesting you say that. I agree.
But yeah. The one thing that they say, and looking through some of the quotes from his book and from other commentators, there's a lot of stuff written about him, and I encourage listeners to go and read it because it's very diverse, which is lovely. He took responsibility as seriously as anything else he did. So that was that, like, as brutal as he was in firing people and up, you know, that's why they called him Neutron Jack, because he literally annihilated people and turned cities that were GE's headquarters and their lifeblood. He turned those cities into ghost towns because the people just got fired and they had to move on. But everything just remained. It was quite scary.
Very, very interesting indeed. It is 8:49. I'm Howard Feldman. This is your Morning Mayhem, 101.9 High FM. Dov says, Jack's legacy is nearly insolvent today. Buffett reckons the economics of a business are stronger than the managers in a business. An interesting one indeed. I'd love your thoughts. 3-4-5-1-9 or 061-895-1019. You know, Zanati, with all of this coronavirus thing happening, there's certain subjects that we've actually forgotten about.
What?
So I did some research. It turns out that SA abalone farming could be in trouble if the coronavirus restrictions don't lift soon.
Oh my goodness. Mm. And we're very fond of abalone here.
We are. We are. We don't know what it is besides ashtrays in the East Rand. But there you have it. First it was riots in Hong Kong. Now a lockdown in mainland China has effectively shut down the South African market for abalone. And the smaller farmers could be in trouble, it would seem. You're still feeding them. You're still incurring the costs. But you have no sales. That's according to Sea Harvest CEO Felix Ratheb or Ratheb. He told Business Insider South Africa. And so there you have it.
Sure.